This is an ABC podcast.
Events getting cancelled. It's just been part of our pandemic lives over the past couple of years. Everyone's been pretty understanding when festivals and gigs have been called off, but you expect to get your money back. So it's pretty wild that some of you have been waiting years. Hey, it's Dave Marchese, and on Hack we're hearing what's going on with these ticket refunds. Also, do you reckon casuals should get sick leave? Because one state in Australia's making it happen.
Hack.
Because they do have a duty of care for young people.
On Triple J.
Who's responsible for protecting young people from climate change? Because one of Australia's highest courts today ruled it's not Environment Minister Susan Lee. You might remember last year a court decided the minister did have a duty of care to protect young people, but the minister appealed and she's won. So what does this all mean looking forward? Well, Joe Lauder explains.
Call the matter for judgment, please.
The full court of the Federal Court of Australia is now in session. Minister for the Environment, Anjali Sharma.
This is a moment that a group of Australian teenagers have been waiting a long time for. And it wasn't the news that they wanted.
As to the posited duty of care, the full court is unanimous in the view that the duty should not be imposed on the minister.
I'm devastated by today's judgment and so, so angry. But it will not deter us in our fight for a safe future.
A couple of years ago, these eight teenagers teamed up with a nun, yes, a nun, to sue the Federal Environment Minister Susan Lee. They argue that the minister has a duty of care to protect young people from the harm caused by climate change. And they argue that she needs to take this into consideration when she's approving projects that cause carbon emissions, and in particular, a coal mine extension in New South Wales. 17-year-old Anjali Sharma is the lead litigant in the case.
This case has always been about young people stepping up. All around you, you are surrounded by young people who are not fooled by empty, useless rhetoric, by excuses and empty promises. You are surrounded by young people who are demanding to be heard on climate change and who will keep fighting for strong climate action in Australia.
Then last year, they won their case. It was really significant and set a legal precedent. But the Environment Minister decided to appeal it, and today the full federal court ruled in the minister's favour, saying no, she doesn't have a duty of care to protect kids from the impact of climate change. Outside the court, Anjali and the other kids involved in the case said that they were disappointed with the outcome.
How many once in a decade, once in a century, once in a thousand years weather events do we need before the government decides that now is the time to take action?
Common sense has prevailed in my view. And I want to just reassure people that I take my responsibilities under the EPBC Act very seriously.
The Federal Environment Minister, Susan Lee, was talking about the decision today, and she was asked by a reporter what her message is for young people.
I would say to young people what I have just said, that I take my responsibilities very seriously, my statutory responsibilities in protecting the environment under the Act, and the reasons for the decisions that I make are always made public, and they underline that very fact.
The government response to today's finding was to say that it remains committed to protecting our environment for current and future generations. That statement is, in my view, entirely at odds with their position on this case in the policy settings they currently have for climate change and our legal framework.
That's David Morris. He's the CEO of the Environmental Defender's Office. He says there were a couple of reasons given by the three justices about why they decided to overturn this court decision. One of the main reasons was that they didn't think that you could draw a clear link between the minister's decision and the impacts of climate change that these kids are going to experience.
They thought it would be too hard to work out what the liability of the minister and the Commonwealth should be in the context of the multiple contributing factors to climate change impacts that they might experience. And they thought that the minister's task under Commonwealth environmental law wasn't really to control carbon emissions.
But there's a bit of a twist. David says the federal court justices didn't dispute the facts laid out in the case about the impacts of climate change, and that's a big deal.
These types of findings about what climate change means for young people and future generations, super powerful. So I think it's likely, despite the loss, that this case will make other legal cases more likely to succeed. And I think time will show how extraordinarily impactful this case has been. I can already think of cases that we're running at the Environmental Defenders Office where these findings of superior courts are going to assist.
This isn't necessarily the end of it all for this case either. There's still the potential for it to go to the High Court, but the kids' legal team have to apply for an appeal to the High Court. They don't automatically get one. Despite the findings, one of the litigants, Ava Princey, told reporters that they are still as committed as ever.
When we filed this case, Australia was reckoning with the worst bushfires in memory. Today, millions are impacted by horrendous floods. This is climate change, and it will only get worse until adults start to act. This means no more fossil fuel approvals and a quick transition to renewables.
Heck, Triple J.
Joe Lauder with that story, and we did ask Environment Minister Susan Lee to come on Hack, but she wasn't available. Your thoughts? Someone says, sounds like the courts ruled the Environment Minister's not responsible for the environment. Another text, this government is great at avoiding responsibility. Well, for a bit of a breakdown about what this all means, I've got Professor Jacqueline Peel with me now. She's an expert in environmental and climate change law. Professor Peel, thanks very much for coming on Hack.
Yeah, great to be with you.
Were you surprised by the ruling today?
Not surprised, perhaps, but definitely disappointed. It was a really important case trying to test the law and see if the law could deliver a better outcome on climate change and for young people who really depend on that. But the court was really conservative in its ruling and basically said that this is an issue to be dealt with by our governments. There's not really a role for the courts to take action on climate change.
How significant was the initial decision, but I guess the whole case, because we had countries all around the world looking on at this, didn't we?
Yeah, look, this case attracted enormous international attention because the arguments that were being put forward were really novel. They were essentially asking the Australian government to have a duty of care towards its own citizens and young children in particular to deal with the harms of climate change. And that really hasn't been done anywhere else in the world. And it was novel because it was kids and children's voices involved in particular to try and make this claim. So it certainly has drawn headlines internationally. And there'll be disappointment felt around the world, I think, in many communities that this case has not got up and that it hasn't been possible for the young people in this case to make out what seems to be a pretty common sense argument, really, that the government should care about them and their future in terms of dealing with climate change.
I'm wondering, Jackie, was the initial decision to hold the minister responsible actually useful? Because the minister still ended up approving a coal mine extension in New South Wales after that initial decision, despite that duty of care existing. So would it have worked anyway?
Yeah, look, in terms of stopping a new coal mine or the coal mine extension, this case didn't produce that result. It was pretty clear that the minister was going to go ahead and approve the coal mine, notwithstanding the decision of the court. The broader impact of this decision was really what it might have meant for other governments, our future government, and also companies in considering what their obligations are, what their responsibilities are when it comes to dealing with the impacts of their activities and how that might contribute to climate change. And there were some important rulings in the case that really reaffirmed the science of climate change, said, look, that these impacts are real, they're going to have really important consequences for children and for future generations, and we can't really ignore them. So that scientific evidence and accepting that climate change is here and needs to be dealt with was a really important part of the first judgment, and that largely remains in place even after the full court decision today.
And so what happens next? Could this go to the High Court now? Is that likely?
Yeah, so that would be the next step, that the plaintiffs in the case would appeal the decision to the High Court. But as your intro explained, this is not a straightforward decision. It's not an automatic right of appeal. You have to apply for special leave to the High Court to hear the appeal. And the High Court may well turn them down and say, actually, there was a unanimous judgment here of the full federal court. There's not really anything else for us to take up with this matter. So it might be that this judgment stands, and we'll have to see. It did seem like the young people involved in the case are really keen to keep up the fight and to pursue it to the final point if they can, and I really hope that that does become possible, but it will be a decision with the High Court as to whether they accept the special application for leave to appeal.
And do you reckon we're going to see more of these kinds of cases in the years ahead, not just here but overseas as well?
Yeah, we're already seeing them. Since 2015, when we saw international agreement on the new framework Paris Agreement for climate change, we've seen an explosion of litigation here in Australia and also in many other countries. And that's just going to continue. It's really featured youth at the forefront of that litigation, because kids and young people understand that this is their future and they've got to fight for it. I think we're only going to see more of those cases. And it's a really big setback with this decision today, but it really just highlights how important it is to keep fighting through the courts and through other means that people have at their disposal to try and get better policy on climate change.
All right, Professor Jacqueline Peel, thank you very much for your time.
Thanks.
And we're hearing from you on the text line as well. Steve says, sounds like the facts were not in dispute, but that linking a climate policy to climate change was in the too hard basket.
Hack. There's a Facebook group called The Drop Festival Still Has My Money or something.
On Triple J.
Tickets to festivals and big gigs aren't cheap. You might be forking out a few hundred bucks for some events, but it's worth it for the experience. You want to be with your friends, have a good time. So what happens if your festival or concert gets cancelled, like we've seen so much over the past couple of years? When do you get your money back? Because some of you have been waiting years for refunds, and the consumer watchdog is saying Ticketek is one of the most complained about companies. Is this you? How long have you been waiting for a refund? I want to know. 1300 055 536. You can message in as well. 0439 757 555. Lou Hill looks into it.
Yeah, I bought the tickets at the start of start of last year.
This may sound familiar, buying tickets 1 or maybe 2 years ago and having the pandemic push gigs back and back and back. Lockie bought tickets to the Harry Styles Love on Tour concert and was beyond excited.
Who doesn't love a bit of Harry? Me and another friend, both. Just love that album to death, and I didn't think it was really possible to go to a Harry Styles concert.
He jumped on Ticketek expecting them to be sold out, but to his luck, he secured 2 tickets to the Sydney show. It cost him $400 Australian, but after seeing videos of the show coming out online, he knew every cent was going to be worth it. But on January 10th, rumours started to spread about the show being cancelled.
First of all, I saw it on Instagram. Yeah, I didn't find out from an email from Ticketek, and not from Harry, from like a news source had posted it. And I was like, oh my God, you're kidding. So 10 days later, Ticketek goes, oh, by the way, it's canned.
Lockie was really disappointed and trusted his refund would come.
And then a couple of weeks went by and I wasn't even thinking about it. And I went, oh, because I have to give the money back to my friend now as well. But I go, oh, I should pay them back. And so I look, I haven't received anything. I go, that's weird.
Lockie ended up reaching out to Ticketek to get things moving, but got this response.
And then someone did respond to me and said they were having trouble finding my booking or confirmation, whatever, and like finding the tickets attached to my details. I bought the tickets under my name, not my friend's name. And so they asked for a confirmation email. So, yeah, that's odd. That's weird that it's not showing up. But, yep, here's the confirmation email.
Siobhan had the exact same problem.
The first email contact I got from them was them telling me that they had no record of me having ever purchased tickets. Like, my name, my order request, my numbers, that wasn't there.
Many said they only got a response from ticketing companies when they threatened to contact the ACCC. When asked about the delay, Ticketek said this.
We are currently processing greater than 20 times more refunds per month. Typically, 90% of fans are automatically refunded within 10 days of cancellation. However, there are always instances where an automatic refund is not successful.
Thankfully, both Lockie and Siobhan received full refunds shortly after we spoke to them, but there's tons of people still waiting for theirs. Libby's been waiting 2 years for her refund. She bought tickets to The Drop in 2020, and after it was cancelled, she says the festival's been dodging requests for refunds.
So I'd contacted Eventbrite to try and get a refund on our tickets initially, and they said you have to contact the organisers. So I'd contacted the organisers and they had said, unfortunately, it's not possible to refund the tickets, and they said until insurance claims are finalised.
At first, Libby was understanding and gave them the benefit of doubt. Their posts on Facebook started to get hundreds of comments like these.
Still no update? This is absolutely beyond a joke.
When are we getting a refund?
More like the flop festival.
There's even a Facebook group called The Drop Still Has My Money.
It's really frustrating to know that you put good faith in these people, understanding that it was out of our hands to begin with, but now 2.5 years pretty much later, they've still got our money.
Into 2021 and now 2022, Libby says there's been little contact and no resolution, leaving her worried to buy tickets in the future.
I was afraid that this could happen again and that we'd end up with, you know, hundreds or thousands of dollars worth tied up with different events. I normally leave it now, like until the week before, to buy a ticket, whereas before I'd buy them as soon as they were on sale.
Hack on Triple J.
Yeah, Lou Hill with that story, with help from the ABC's specialist reporting team. And we're hearing from you. Someone says, I've been waiting since the start of the pandemic for The Drop to pay back 4 tickets. Stringing you along to say they'll pay is the biggest issue. Well, let's get into that one, actually, because we've heard from a few of you waiting for your money from The Drop. With me now is Ken O'Brien. He's the managing director of the Drop Music Festival, which we heard still owes ticket holders. Ken, thanks very much for coming on Hack.
No problem.
It's been 2 years since The Drop cancelled festivals across the country. Where are you up to with the refund process for people?
We were left in a very difficult position with the cancellation of the third festival. It was cancelled the night before the show, leaving us responsible for about $900,000 worth of costs for that particular show. Then our insurers denied our valid insurance policy, which left us with no alternative than to fight the battle with them, which took about 13 months. But in the end, they paid an interim instalment of $630,000, and then we battled to recover more from there.
So have you been paying people back since then with the money that you received?
So what we did, Dave, in the interim of all that, we paid suppliers out of our available cash, because most of the suppliers in the entertainment game are family businesses. We felt really terrible about that. So we paid probably 50% of the suppliers out. We then took the difficult decision, against the situation we had then, to pay out the balance of the suppliers and then to commence a process of raising capital to take the business forward, with the view of offering the punters another show that they could take up against the ticket of the show they didn't see, and or receive a refund.
What you're saying is you can't refund ticket holders until you hold more events. Why not?
We had to recapitalise the business to allow us to take the shows forward and offer the punters shows in the future, and or refunds to the punters.
And look, a lot of people can have sympathy with businesses in the music industry that have been hit hard by COVID cancellations and restrictions and all the rest of it. But we've got people who've waited 2 years, Ken, and a lot of these people are young people who, you know, a few hundred dollars is a lot of money for them. They've been getting updates saying, oh, we've got good news, we've reached a deal with insurers, we'll be able to repay people, but deadlines have come and passed. What happens if you can't hold festivals again? What's going to happen to all this money?
We could have gone down another path, Dave, and just liquidated the company and moved on. We're not those sort of people. We are not going anywhere. We're not running away with the money. We're not spending, haven't spent the money on anything. So we have every intention of returning to market, and we will return to market. I assure you we will. And we'll offer the punters the option to take those shows or a refund.
So when can, like, when will people see their money? Because that's the thing that they're asking us. We just want to have a clear time frame, and it just, the goalposts keep moving every few months.
I would expect that we'll be in a position to announce the shows come the end of, by the latest by the end of June, at which time the punter will be able to take up the option of that show and or a refund.
Other festivals have had to cancel and have managed to refund ticket holders. So what has been the problem with you guys doing that?
In running six festivals, there's an enormous amount of expense, and we were only able to conclude two. We were able to claim cancellation against the Manly event, but not all the costs incurred against the other events. So we've been out hundreds of thousands of dollars, and we used all of the capital that we had ourselves to make good and pay bands and pay local suppliers, but we didn't have sufficient to deal with the refunds.
A lot of ticket holders have lost faith, and I'm sure you can understand why they would after 2 years yep. without seeing their money. Yep. They're not going to want to go to a rescheduled festival. Are you guaranteeing that full refunds are going to be available for those people by the end of the year?
Correct.
Right.
Absolutely.
Okay. And when are you giving ticket holders another update?
We'll give them a firm update by this time next month.
All right. Well, there are a lot of people who are going to be anxiously waiting. I mean, they've been waiting for years, and yep. they're going to hold you to account. If you've said it's by the end of the year, they'll be expecting that.
Yep. And I don't begrudge them having that expectation. We greatly appreciate their patience. And I know it's gone beyond wearing thin. We need to make good, and we have every intention of making good. Everything I've just told you is 100% fact.
All right, well, we'll stay on top of this. Ken O'Brien from The Drop, thanks for coming on Hack.
No problem, Doc. Cheers.
Hack on Triple J.
Yeah, we're hearing from a lot of you. Somebody says, well, I bought tickets for The Drop Festival in Manly for myself and eight friends, 140 ahead in early 2020. Event got cancelled, as we just heard, sent many emails and have received no reply. Another person says, I bought tickets to Cable Ties 2 years ago from OzTix. I emailed them after a year asking for a refund, but they said no because it was going to be rescheduled. They've only just given me a refund. And somebody else says, punters, is that slang for mugs? A very disrespectful term. These are people.
Hack.
So many workers have to choose between going to work sick or feeding their kids, paying their rent.
On Triple J.
One of the worst things about being a casual is knowing you can never be sick, because you've got to show up to work when you're feeling crap just to make sure you can pay your rent. So imagine how good it would be if you got sick leave as a casual. It's being trialled in Victoria and it has a lot of people excited, so we want to find out a bit more about it. Felicity Salbutz is from the Young Workers Centre and she's going to help unpack this. Felicity, g'day. Thanks for coming on Hack.
No worries. Great to be on the show this afternoon.
A lot of people really excited about this trial. Who would be eligible for sick leave under this program in Victoria?
Yeah, like you said, so many workers are so excited to hear of this announcement yesterday. It's estimated that 150,000 casuals and self-employed Victorian workers are eligible. And so the scheme covers workers in hospitality and retail, as well as aged care and disability workers, cleaners, laundry workers and security guards. So it make a huge difference to so many working people's lives.
Yeah, so many people would be covered by that. But what happens to penalties? Would casuals stop getting those because they're now getting sick leave?
No, not at all. Workers' pay is not being cut. And casual workers obviously don't know if they'll receive shifts tomorrow or next week. And that 25% load-in that casuals receive goes some distance to compensate them for the insecurity of their work. They still have that insecurity of work and they'll still be receiving their casual loading.
Who's paying for this? That's a big question I'm sure a lot of people have.
Right now, the Victorian government is funding and administrating the two-year pilot program. So we really commend the Victorian government for showing real leadership and being trailblazers here. They've identified a problem and they've stepped in. You know, casuals have never had access to sick leave before, and this will make such a difference.
We're hearing from people on the text line. Somebody says 100% yes to sick leave for casuals. We've also got someone on the line. River, you're a cleaner. What's been your experience in terms of not being well and having to work?
Yeah, hi. I've been a cleaner for 7 years now, and 2 years ago I had a really, really bad car accident that caused me a lot of damage to my back, and it put me in a really bad position because I couldn't afford my medical bills, but I needed to work to be able to pay to fix my back.
Wow.
So I had to work through quite a lot of pain just to be able to, you know, get better. So it would have really helped back then. I'm so glad it's coming through now.
Yeah, I bet. I bet. And I imagine, Felicity, well, thanks very much, River, for letting us know. Felicity, I imagine you hear very similar stories to River's all the time. Do you think the pandemic highlighted how dangerous it can be having people coming to work while they're sick?
Definitely. We saw during the pandemic the devastating effects of insecure work, and that turning up to work when you're sick can be really dangerous. We saw so many outbreaks from workplaces, and it was because workers without sick pay and carers leave, through no fault of their own, have to make a difficult and often heartbreaking decision between turning up to work when they're sick and paying the bills, or staying at home and struggling to pay rent that month. You know, we have a collective responsibility to keep each other safe, and that's why this announcement is so great for so many workers, especially young workers who find themselves in casualised and insecure work.
Jill's messaged in, says, totally agree with sick leave for casuals. If sick leave can't be paid out for part or full-time workers, then why can't it can be paid out for part or full-time workers? Why can't a similar system happen for casuals, as it's almost a redundancy system with that logic? This is just Victoria at the moment, Felicity. Is there some kind of hope that it could become a national scheme?
Look, I would love to see that. I know so many young workers and workers more generally would love to see the Morrison government step up to the plate and introduce a system like this federally. You know, the federal government has had the opportunity to fix this issue, and so far they've chosen not to. And so, like I said, I really commend the Victorian government for showing real leadership here and being trailblazers. But there's nothing to stop the Morrison government from introducing a scheme just like this across the country, which would impact and assist and help hundreds of thousands of workers across Australia if they were to do so.
Let's hear from another one of our listeners. Ruby, you work in hospital. I imagine you've probably had to go to work sick before. Is it something that's been a real issue in the past?
Oh, yeah, definitely. Throughout the pandemic, like me and my co-workers, all casual and hospitality, having to come to work sick. And it's just like the pressure from bosses as well to make you feel bad if you're calling in sick, you're not being a team player, that sort of thing. So, yeah, it's definitely, I think the paid sick leave definitely empowers people to be able to take their health seriously.
And is it a thing, Ruby, as well, like not wanting to call in sick, not just to lose the money, but because you think you might not get more shifts or anything like that?
Yeah, definitely. Like I said, like there's definitely the pressure coming from management and the bosses and that sort of thing. So, you know, if not just feeling guilty, like you might actually have some real repercussions, like not getting enough shifts later on.
Yeah, for sure. Thanks very much for calling in, Ruby. Felicity, I imagine that there's a bit of worry that it might be overturned if the government wins the Victorian election. We've just got 20 seconds left. Is that a bit of a worry for you guys?
Well, look, I think every worker across Victoria deserves sick leave. It should be a basic entitlement that all workers are entitled to. And I think that this is a scheme that should be here for the long haul, because as we've seen, insecure work and workers turning up to work sick is really dangerous.
All right, Felicity Salbutz from the Young Workers Centre, thank you very much for your time.
Thank you for having me.
Hack on Triple J.
That's Felicity Salbutz from the Young Workers Centre. And that's all we've got time for on the Hack podcast for now. I'll catch you next time.